Monster Man, Special Episode, The Gods of Glorantha.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers. And in particular, of Patreon backer Yepa, who's asked me to talk about the gods and myths of Glorantha. Wait a minute. Gods and myths? Does that mean this is not an episode of Monster Man, but instead an episode of Patron Deities? One second. Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway, and in this episode, we're going to be talking about the gods and myths of Glorantha. We'll start with an example from a Gloranthan myth, and then talk about the three principles that I think make Gloranthan mythology better than any other mythology in fantasy roleplaying. Remember, all of this is brought to you by Patreon backer Yepa. If you'd like to be like Yepa and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do, you'll also get the rewards for other levels, including monthly bonus content and my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Yepa, thank you very much for your support. I hope that you enjoy your episode, and I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name again. So Glorantha. One of the things that you can really tell about Glorantha is that its creator, the late Greg Stafford, and the other people who worked on it were really interested in mythology and religion, not just in knowing tales of gods and heroes, but in the role that mythology and religion played in people's lives. Now, Glorantha has been being written about since the 1960s. It actually predates the role-playing game RuneQuest. It was originally a setting for war games like a Hex Encounter war games. And some of the understanding of myth that was common in those days is not really what scholars of religion necessarily believe anymore. But it works for several reasons. The first and most important, and we'll return to this later, is that Stafford and the other creators of Glorantha never abandoned the role of the human in this mythology. So even if you think that maybe, you know, what they thought about how myths work was not necessarily right, they connected it to human life and game activity in ways that made it feel vital and exciting. And the second is that a lot of that scholarship, I mean, the flaw with it was that it was more focused on good storytelling than, you know, good scholarship necessarily, or at least scholarship that would hold up today. But that makes it great for gaming, right? Remember, this is not an anthropology lesson. It's a fantasy religion. So if this game were set in the real world, that'd be a different story, maybe. So a disclaimer as well before we start, the world of Glorantha is very religiously diverse, and there are areas of it that I don't know that much about. I really don't know that much about religion in places like Teshnos or Kralorella or Pameltella. I mainly know the areas that everybody knows, right? So the Dragon Pass region, the Lunar Empire, Prak. The world of Glorantha is a very varied one, but those ones are the places that most Gloranthan products are set. Those are the ones that I know the most about. And we're mainly going to talk about the theistic cultures of Dragon Pass and kind of sort of the Lunar Empire, by which I mean it's kind of sort of theistic. So yeah, mainly going to talk about those myths and those faiths. I think the first Gloranthan game I played was actually the computer game King of Dragon Pass, which I was sent a review copy by the Gaming Outpost. If you remember the Gaming Outpost, that's how long ago this was. But I had previously read some Gloranthan stuff in the old Interregnum APA, specifically stuff about the Ralios Wilds campaign. And it struck me as just feeling and sounding very different from most write-ups of role-playing games that I'd read, and that it felt like reading a saga, or more like reading a saga than most RPG campaign descriptions sounded like. And then, you know, I made some friends who were Gloranthophiles and learned more about the setting and read more Glorantha material. And because some of my friends are pretty hardcore, I actually, among the earliest things I read were things that are kind of mainly intended for completists, like The Fortunate Succession or The Glorious Reascent of Yelm, which are in-universe texts about the mythologies of some of these cultures. So that has always been what appealed to me about it. And indeed, kind of one of my favorite parts of, you know, the mythology of Glorantha is the way that it's written about in King of Sartar, the kind of sort of novel put together from all of these in-world documents. It's not really a novel, but it does tell a story. How about that? Many stories, perhaps. So I'm going to start with one of the texts that affected me so much the first time I read it. This is one of a series of little fragments that are scattered throughout various Glorantha books called the Johnstown Compendium. And they are like fragments that exist in this library in the game setting. And because Glorantha has such a long and complex publishing history, many of these appear in multiple places. I'm quoting it from the Hero Wars book Storm Tribe, The Cults of Sartar, but there are probably many other places that it turns up. In this extract, a member of the Orlanthi culture, the kind of barbarian, quote-unquote barbarian people who inhabit the Dragon Pass region, is describing a myth and a vision he had relating to that myth. Johnstown Compendium, number 2997. Umoth is the first storm, who separated earth and sky to make the air realm, and who was later punished by being chained between them for all eternity. After Jagrakriand chained Umoth, all of his children treated him as if he was dead, except Orlanth. Orlanth stood atop the peak of his mother's house. Kero Finn, the mighty mountain, is the place where he was born, the center of the world. All around him the winds raged, covering the broad land with white snow where it wanted to, and burying the frozen earth where it wished. On top of the mountain, Orlanth could see his ancient father, the prisoner god, tied to earth and sky. Orlanth asked him for advice, and he replied to his youngest and most faithful son, "I cannot move. The triad makes the wind. There is one calling you. Follow it. There is another hunting you. Avoid it. There is the third, unknowable, which you fear." After listening to these words of wisdom, Orlanth gazed upon the whole of the changing horizon around him. Nine gods he saw. Winter King, Lord of the North, with his lover frozen for his entertainment. Gore and Gash, one with broken legs and the other with broken teeth. Fog Girl, the only thing moving upon the face of the seas. Iron Man, implacable, crushing the ice underfoot as he chased seals. Uroks, doing the dervish dance that hurts his people. Drought, once again escaped from his brass jar. Sky Terror, knocked from the sky and now plucking among the ruins of Agantharltilion. Darkness Mother, the pregnant darkness who reclines in a cave. Jirani, son of Ragorn, sometimes called the Mountain Glider. I did this as well. It is always icy there. I prayed to Umoth, the grandfather, and I saw him far to the south, chained upon the spike with his arms in the sky and his legs in the earth. He said to me, "I cannot move. The triad makes the wind. There is one calling you. Follow it. There is another hunting you. Avoid it. There is the third unknowable which you fear." I looked about the horizon, but I saw only five gods. Zorak Zoran, whose evil son had been wounded by the Monthi stones. Mostal, bearing death iron. Besgezos, the son of Tyram, plucking among the ruins of Agantharltilion. Valand, god of winter, whose lover was frozen for his entertainment. Jirani, son of Ragorn, sometimes called the Mountain Glider. Now, if, like me, you're a big Glorantha nerd, there's a lot to go over there. You may know, for instance, that Jagrakriant is the Orlanthi name for the Darahappan god Shargash. Or you might know that Gore and Gash are two heroes of the troll race who appeared during a battle in which the Trollkin curse was placed on the trolls. Or you might find it notable that the only person whose name doesn't change is Jirani, son of Ragorn, which makes sense in a way because he is the one closest to the person writing this text. He too is a human Orlanthi, he's like a semi-divine human, but he's not someone like Valand, who is a very powerful god. But that sort of doesn't matter, is really the point. As far as I know, little else is known about Besgezos, the son of Tyram. I know nothing about him, and I looked him up on the Glorantha Wiki for this episode, and as far as I can tell, the main source for him is this extract from the Johnstown Compendium. But it makes sense that the text would not solely contain easily recognizable references. Like any text, it would include things that are perplexing and strange and outsidey. But it's doing something very important, right? The mystery of it all is appealing. That's appealing to me. But the thing that makes Glorantha work is that you don't need to solve it. What matters is the image of the writer undertaking a quest to emulate his god and receiving a cryptic vision in return. We can assume that whatever that vision may or may not mean to us, it meant something to the person who wrote the text. And this leads me to the bit where I talk about why I love Glorantha religion specifically as a game element. There are three reasons. First,
Glorantha religion encourages player action. This is particularly important in the Orlanthi religion, but it's true in others as well. So the Orlanthi religion specifically encourages players not to turtle. For example, one of Orlanth's precepts is, mistakes are made and then fixed. It is an article of faith for the Orlanthi that to do something, even the wrong something, is better than doing nothing. Because one of their central myths is the myth of the Lightbringer's quest. When Orlanth killed the sun god Yelm, he descended into the underworld, plunging the world into darkness. And in that darkness, all kinds of terrible things happened. So Orlanth got together a band of companions, and he undertook a quest to retrieve Yelm from the underworld. This was only partially successful. All sorts of things in Glorantha stem from this, right? But that's why the sun is up sometimes and down sometimes. The Orlanthi religion also encourages creative problem solving. So Ernalda, the earth goddess, Orlanth's wife, one of her most important teachings is, there is always another way. This is positioned in opposition to the Orlanthi teaching that violence is always an option, but it's a great message for player characters. You know, there isn't just one way to solve this problem. Similarly, the Lunar religion is all about like discovering, confronting, and incorporating your other. Whereas maybe previous religions would have thought about discovering, confronting, and defeating your other, the Lunar faith is about the reconciliation of opposites. But it's about going and encountering things and having new experiences. They are presented as role models and calls to action, not long lists of thou shalt nots, right? They encourage rather than restrict, for the most part. Maybe things are different in Mineria, I don't know. Second, Glorantha mythology is interactive. So the central part of that relationship between Glorantha characters and myth is the action of hero questing, in which characters undertake a ritual recreation of a god's deeds, again, speaking specifically for people practicing theistic magic, which then can become an actual supernatural recreation of the god's deeds. It's not exactly the same, but it sends them on an adventure. And what that means is that the myths of Glorantha mythology aren't just something the GM lectures you about, or at best, something that might deliver a clue that you need to solve a puzzle in the dungeon. They are experiences that you can have. So for instance, when I ran my Hero Quest game, which was set in Dragon Pass, but in its past, so before the creation of the Kingdom of Sartar, I began the game, I didn't want to give the player characters a whole lot of homework to learn about Orlanthi culture. So I began the game with the characters as kids. I ran them through one simple scenario, and then they underwent their initiation rite. And the initiation rite is a kind of hero quest. And so at one point, someone had mentioned to them the idea of this event in the history, or the prehistory, really, of the Orlanthi people called the I Fought We Won battle. It's actually not just Orlanthi. Lots of different peoples were involved in I Fought We Won. And in the Great Darkness, when they were forced to confront chaos as part of their initiation rite, they found themselves alone facing their enemy. And calling on a secret that they had learned during that quest, they suddenly felt the presence of all these other Orlanthi and non-Orlanthi heroes all standing up against chaos together with them. That everyone else was out there also fighting their own individual battle, but all against the same foe. And one of the players exclaimed, with sudden realization, I fought, we won! And that is the kind of experience that you have to have participatory mythology to get. Maybe players who got super excited about, I don't know, the Testament of Longinus or whatever, you know, some other game's mythology, but it's not the same as experiencing it. And the world of Glorantha is set up such that mythology is something that player characters experience. Thirdly and finally, Glorantha religion prompts compelling conflict, or at least it can. As much as I hate to say it, let me tell you about my character. So in the first Hero Quest, maybe the second, in a Hero Quest game that I played in, I played a character who was an officer in the Lunar military. And he was from a province of the Lunar Empire called Darjeen. And traditionally, you know, at various points in their history, the Darjeeni have been subjugated by their neighbors in the solar culture of Darahapa. And Darahapans regard Darjeeni as like the natives, you know. They're like fun-loving and they like a drink and they love to go swimming and they're not hard workers. And, you know, they look down on them. But it is an important teaching of the Lunar faith that, you know, those divisions are abolished, right? The traditional rights of the Darahapan aristocracy no longer matter in a world where we are all unified
in the worship of the Red Goddess. There's a hierarchy in the Lunar Empire, but in theory, it's not that one. Now, in practice, it kind of is. So my lunar character was an initiate of the lunar military god, Yanafal Tarnals. And devotion to that god is pretty common among lunar army officers. So right at the very beginning of the campaign, I was being given my mission by my superiors in the military, who were all snobby Darahappan aristocrats, you know, who were initiates of the various solar and star cults, and looked down on me as a Dargini. And at one point, someone said, well, of course, you'll understand that. You're a Dargini. And I said, I'm a lunar. I'm a citizen of the Empire and an officer in the Imperial Army. I did not add, we are all us, which I should have, but I didn't. So on the one hand, poor old Berkut Uru, for such was his name, was not accepted by the hierarchy that existed contrary to what he understood as the teachings of his faith. But then at the same time, his initiation into Yanafal Tarnals essentially cut him off from being able to participate in the religious rites of his troops. So he loved Dargina the Dargini, and he loved his troops and wanted what was best for them, but he could never really be one of them because they were not lunars. They maintained the traditional Dargini spiritual beliefs, and because of the way the mechanics work, he could never really fully participate in those. So the religious structures of the setting created this really interesting conflict for my character, who was striving to be the lunarest lunar that ever there was, and believing that the lunar faith would therefore make him equal to other people in the imperial hierarchy, and finding out that that kind of wasn't true, you know, maybe winding up as a man without a country. The campaign tailed off before we really were able to explore all that stuff. And then, of course, Under the Red Moon came out and sort of spoiled everything by creating a specifically lunar Dargini thing that he could just have slotted into easily. There are moments where some of the stuff in there feels like someone has designed it based on what would make a good empire rather than what would make a good game, but that's a different story. Similarly, like, I'm no expert on the Sun Dome Templars, but these are characters in the Prax part of the setting who are servants of, they're sort of militaristic followers of the strict and legalistic sun god Yelmalio, but they're also, as far as I can tell, running a protection racket. Like, and I don't mean a kind of, like, you know, I'm not comparing the activities of a state to a protection racket. I'm saying it's organized crime. So the setting remembers that people are not in conformity, almost nobody is ever in conformity with their or their culture's religious ideals. They are in conversation with those ideals. They feel bad when they do things that are wrong according to those ideals, but that doesn't mean that everybody just follows the teachings of their faith all the time. And because everybody in a Gloranthan setting is magical and everybody is religious, if you're playing a game set in a kind of consistent setting, religious festivals and religious rites are going to be a big part of how, like, time is marked. And even if you're a band of picaresque wanderers, you're always going to be running into shrines and pilgrims and whatever. Religion is as important in Glorantha as in real life. Maybe more so, because, you know, sometimes a giant bat will come and, like, eat your city. But what that means is that you don't get the pressure that, say, if you're playing D&D and you have a cleric, typically the cleric will be an extremely pious character and they'll be the only character that's religious at all. When there's just one of a type of character, they often feel a sense that they ought to be a good example of that type. But if everybody's that type of character, then you feel like you're allowed to have more variety. So I think that the ubiquity of religion and conversations about religion, I mean, not religion in the contemporary sense, but like of a relationship with the divine or the spiritual or whatever, can lead to a lot of interesting conflict in games set in Glorantha. So, me personally, I find the aesthetic of, like, the fragmentary mythology incredibly appealing. It speaks to the same things that motivated me to become an early medieval historian instead of a modern historian, which is what I was originally studying to be. But I accept that that doesn't appeal to everybody. But I think that the action-encouraging, interactive nature of Gloranthan mythology, that it's not just something that you learn a bunch of trivia about and then repeat to people, but something that you participate in, and something that then gives you motivation to do stuff in the game world and motivation to have conflicts with the setting and with other characters, that's what's really good about it, as opposed to what appeals to me about it specifically. Yeah, I mean, I love it. I can't speak highly enough. I keep wanting to run another HeroQuest game, but you know, I got a pretty full schedule. Anyway, that's about all the Glorianthin mythology that I have time for today, although I could go on forever. Yep, I hope that you enjoyed your special episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to get your own special episode, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're going to be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. And we're going to be taking a look at elves, two different kinds of elves, one of them dark, one of them wet. So join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.